Session number 12585, Reel 3.
Mr. Clayton, Reel 3.
Decision was to get some sleep, expecting a tough day the following day. So I went to sleep behind one of these big boulders. I was awakened by a comrade, and I can only guess the time. Some time such as midnight or a short while after, I should think. And he was saying that the New Zealanders had come up the hill and they were retreating, and that the Marines were going with them. They'd advised that the Marines should go with them. And I could see such a group of men. The moonlight was very bright. The Germans had chosen a moonlight night for the invasion, moonlight conditions. I could see these men in a big group, and then they moved off in single file, and I moved off towards them with my comrade, and I was the last in this group of people moving away from the hill. Now I could see this long line of men going along a small path. The moonlight was very bright, and a man was standing beside the retiring men, and he seemed to be questioning them as they were passing him. And I was musing on what he could be asking them and who he would be. And then when I got nearer, I noticed that he was a field ambulance man with the Red Cross. And so I looked lower down, I saw a stretcher. And he was asking for a man to help him with the stretcher. And of course I was the last in the row, and inevitably it would be me, you see. And he said, I arrived abreast of him. He said, "For God's sake, Tommy, don't let me down." I said, "Of course I won't." And I had to sling my rifle. Until then I had it at the ready. I had to sling it in order to take up the stretcher. And this New Zealander knew of the position where the wounded were being gathered, you see. And we set off. And these retreating men were out of sight by that time. And the New Zealander led me over the terraces. And there was such a lot of stone terraces where the vineyards were. And we had to struggle over them with this wounded man. And to get down into the valley. And we came to a place where there were a large number of wounded on each side of a path. And he put the wounded man down. And several other field ambulance men were there. And I wondered what was to become of me, you know. They suggested that I should stay with them and surrender if necessary. For they said the hill is now undefended. So it really seemed that the Germans would occupy that hill and that they would be there in force. And we were just down at the eastern side of it, you see, where this field ambulance position was. So I didn't like the idea of surrendering, for the Germans had had it so bad that I imagined that they wouldn't take kindly to taking prisoners. So I heard a force of men coming towards me, marching. So I ran away from the path side and crouched down. This unit of men came along the path. And when they came opposite, I saw the silhouettes. I saw our familiar steel helmets. So I joined forces with, I tagged in at the back. And I asked them what unit they were. And this was the 28th Maori Battalion. So I said, where have you been? And they said they'd been to try to reinforce Colonel Andrew in charge of the New Zealanders at the western end of the airfield. And they said that when they got there, the place was vacant. There was no one there at all. And that they'd had to come back to get further instructions, and they didn't know whether the unit that they were reinforcing was wiped out or if it had retired, but that they had no information at all. So that they were going to go back to their headquarters at Platanias, about 3.5 miles further to the east. So if the New Zealanders had waited only a short while longer, they would have been reinforced. The Maoris were there. And they had very powerful machine guns. They demolished them from, they'd stripped them off from hurricanes on the airfield. Wrecked hurricanes. Browning machine guns. They had quite a few of these. And large belts of ammunition, a very effective weapon. And I'm sure that the island would have been held if... that's the tragedy of it. That they were the reinforcements and they got there too late. So they came away. I mean, one might think, shouldn't they have stayed there? They were a fresh force, you see. For no parachutist landed on Platania, so these men were very fresh.
So what did you do once you'd had this conversation with them?
I stayed with them, and they attached me to C Company. And I'd no idea where the Marines would be, my units. I'd no idea. In fact, they had gone much further east to Hania. We called it Kania then, KH starts with. They'd gone right to Hania. I became attached to the Maori Battalion. So their headquarters were at Platanias, on the coast.
This would be the 21st of May, would it?
Yes, the 21st of May, yes. So we arrived at their headquarters, which was on a hill at Platanias. Covered with very big pine trees. I believe Platanias is the name for pines in Greek. When we got to the hilltop, they had slit trenches, defences, dug. And apparently two companies had gone to the airfield, C Company and another one, I think it was C and D, and that A and B had remained at Platanias. So as we arrived, A and B took off, and they came down the hill, and they went westward along the coastal plain. To do whatever was possible in the effort of retaking the airstrip. So this would be very early in the forenoon that we arrived back, and that the other two companies of the Maori battalion set off towards Malimi Airfield. And they were going well within our sight, along the coastal plain. There was a path, not a road, at this area. And incredibly, Junkers 52s were coming in again. Now, if they'd gone to the west of the airfield, they could have dropped them and lost no men at all. And they hadn't the information to know that they'd suffered enormous losses to the east. And they dropped a battalion of men right on top of the Maoris. And the men with me were jumping in glee. The Maoris within our sight in this open area, in the plain, we knew they were delighted, and they were firing to left and right. And this battalion was decimated, absolutely. They dropped right on top of the Maoris, who they were really spoiling for it, you know.
Did you join in with this?
No, we were too far. We were a mile away, you see. Oh, the Maoris were delighted, and the officers, they had the binoculars, and they were grinning from ear to ear, and they were delighted. Now, it seemed to me, even at that time, that the Germans had had such enormous losses that if only we could have prevented them from landing men on the airfield, that they would have had to give up very quickly. But the point is that they got command of this hill 10.107, which we didn't know it as that at that time. They'd got command of it, and they'd captured most of the airfield. It was still being raked by machine gun fire. They'd captured most of it when they actually started landing troop carriers onto it. The very day after the initial invasion, they were landing troop carriers directly onto the airfield. And we could see this taking place from this high hill in Platanias. The troop carriers were coming in very low, and some of those were shot down into the sea. A few, and some were turning and coming into the airstrip, and they were landing, successfully landing. And of course they were getting heavy supplies in, and men. They were able to take off again, and the airfield was still under machine gun fire. Within a short time, the British six-inch battery, I don't know much about it. It was close to Hania, and they'd got the range of the airfield, and they were shelling the airfield, and Junkers 52s were crashing into the shell holes. And I learnt later from our number one Beaufort gun, the crew were taken prisoner, and that one of their jobs was to help to be clearing the troop carriers away to make room for to clear a landing strip. But troop carriers were crashing and being damaged beyond repair, and they were being piled up at the sides of the airstrip. And in spite of that, the Germans kept on landing them. Of course, they had to do, and they were getting this big unit of mountain troops into Crete. This really devastated us. They were very soon, they were powerful enough to be able to push our men away from the eastern edge of the airfield until they commanded it entirely. But they'd captured the Bofors and they were using them, you see, against our troops. Things were really in their favour then. That what was necessary was to have held point 107, to have held that, and then the enemy could not have landed any troop carriers. I think the biggest mistake of all was not to have a unit away to the west of Malmö. At Rethymnon, it was defended from all sides, and the same at Heraklion, and they'd no trouble at all in holding those airfields. Now, we couldn't hold the one at Malmö. Now, the New Zealand battalions of the brigade, which were to the east of Malmö airfield, they were only engaged in mopping up after such a successful day. And if only they'd reinforced the battalion which was in trouble at the western edge of the airfield, and yet the brigade commander wouldn't allow it because of the imminent invasion that was threatened by sea, the convoy that was expected. And General Freyberg also expected the convoy to come, and he vetoed the movement of troops to, at least he did at first, the first essential day, you see, the first day when it would have, like a stitch in time would have saved nine, you see, if he'd got reinforcements there. And he wanted to keep them in the Bay of Hania against the threat of the convoy, which did actually come. But it was our contention that he should have trusted the Navy. The Navy was there, and in fact they did sink this convoy. So he had all these troops who could have, virtually without any trouble, they could have held the airfield. Now, he did send the Maoris, but they set off so late, you see, and they came from 3.5 miles away, while there was three battalions of white New Zealanders in closer to the scene of battle, you see, which they should have been the ones, or indeed they should have gone also with the Maoris and not worried about the convoy because, of course, the Navy was there. That's the tragedy.
So what's happened to you next?
Well, the General Freyberg decided to make an offensive against the airfield to try to retake it. And this was going to be the Maori battalion to the south of the coastal road, and New Zealand battalions to the seaward side of the coast road. So this would be a powerful force. And we were going to attack in darkness, when the Germans were not very great in darkness. They didn't enjoy night fighting at all. And I was with the Maoris to the south of the road. And the officers were saying to take no prisoners. We spread out in a single line.
Why do you think he said take no prisoners?
We wouldn't be able to cope with them. We wouldn't be able to get them back because we needed all the force that was possible. And however, once again, the effort seemed really to be half-hearted from the general's point of view. For he wouldn't let us advance early enough because the New Zealanders at the seaward side of the road, their job, their position until then had been to face the invading convoy, and he wouldn't let them advance with the Maoris until they were reinforced from Georgiopolis, which was 15 miles away. A couple of Australian battalions were coming to relieve them, and that when the Australians arrived, then the offensive could take place, which was ridiculous, really. We desired to leave as early as possible because the more daylight we had, the greater opportunity we had of success. And we lost many hours. I think it was approaching midnight by the time we did start an advance. We lost many hours before the Australians did arrive. They were delayed, you see. And the general still would not let the attack take place until the white New Zealanders were relieved. And we went forward, westwards. And the night was very dark. There was a lot of machine gun fire. Now, it was all tracer fire. And we soon found out that this was a terrible blunder on the Germans' part, that they were revealing each position where they were, and that we could ignore the fire until it was coming our way and then crouch down and it would pass over us. And then as soon as it passed over us, we could get up and march forward again, and we would throw a few grenades into these machine gun nests and wipe them out with no trouble at all. Although we didn't have many grenades, it soon became a point of going in with the bayonets, fixed bayonets.
Did you do that?
Yes. But the Germans were very, very worried about night fighting, and these machine gun nests were hopelessly outwitted by their mistake of using tracer. But we could get very close.
How did you feel about going in with a bayonet?
Well, I think it was the adrenaline, you see. And the necessity was so great. And trying to get as close as possible to the airfield and not wishing to waste time. And the Maoris were such warriors. And they regarded me as something of a mascot. And I daren't let them have the feeling that they were doing it all. I felt obliged. being the only white man, I was just terribly afraid of seeming to be chicken, you know. It's not really bravado, but it's a kind of pride, really. But this happened again, not long after this, that it started to get a little bit daylight. And in any case, we just couldn't get any further because my platoon had gone along a gully which was travelling, which was westward, you see. We were going along a gully and until we were quite held up by fire from the top of the gully. There was such an exchange of fire before dawn that several Germans were on the top of the gully firing into it. They heard our voices and we were returning fire. And there was no cover from fire, just a few olives, but they were just skimpy, not very large. And one of the Maoris was hit by machine gun fire, small machine pistols, Schmeissers. And we were really pinned down when dawn came. The gully was about 15 feet deep, and the Germans were in force at one side of the gully, that we could have gone back. But I think the platoon commander was worried about going back, really. And yet he was bewildered about what to do about this, that this fire was coming at us constantly from the top of the gully. A stream was running along the gully, and the platoon corporal, sent a messenger along the stream back to the main force of Maoris to report that he was pinned down with his platoon. And after a short while, a New Zealand officer came to our platoon. And this man was a legend. They'd told me about him often. He scorned a steel helmet. He had a peaked cap on. And a pistol, no rifle. And he was furious. He said, "You've no right to be pinned down." He said, "You outnumber them." They said, we don't know how many there are. And he said, "They're quiet now, they are not firing." So he said, "Fix bayonets and charge up the side of the gully." So this was a frightening, a daunting thing. That's I fixed bayonets, the Maoris fixed bayonets. And we climbed up the gully. There was plenty.